Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Science, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Galina Limarenko, doctoral candidate in neuroscience with a focus on biochemistry and molecular biology of neurodegenerative diseases at the EPFL in Switzerland, the host of the channel. Today we'll be talking to John Troyer about his new book, Technologies of the Human Corpse. The relationship of the dead body with technology throughout history, from 19th century embalming machines to the death prevention technologies of today. Death and a dead body have never been more alive in the public imagination, not least because of current debates over the modern medical technology that is deployed. It seems expressly to keep human bodies from dying, blurring the boundary between alive and dead. In his book, John Troyer examines the relationship of the dead body with technology, both material and conceptual, the physical machines, political concerns, and sovereign institutions that humans use to classify, organize, repurpose, and transform the human corpse. Doing so, he asks readers to think about death, dying, and dead bodies in a radically different ways. Well, John, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm very excited to be on the program. This is great. Thank you so much for the invitation.
Oh, it's great to have you. It is such a joyful subject as well. So, as we have witnessed the unprecedented times during the global pandemic, I would like to ask, how has it affected your work and you, and also maybe some main takeaways that you have gathered from all of this experience?
No, that's a great question, Galina. And so there are a couple of different responses I have to the pandemic, and I've been asked about them in lots of different ways. So, first of all, I just want to extend condolences isn't even the right word, but, you know, to everyone who lost or had someone they knew or a family member die related to COVID. That certainly I had, you know, friends from my own like high school or college certainly had friends and family die. I was very fortunate that my own parents, who certainly were in high risk categories themselves, didn't die, were able to be vaccinated. But I think, you know, the one thing that I was really, I'm still angry about this actually, was for years, I and colleagues worked on mass disaster, mass fatality, pandemic response planning. That was part of what we did, and wrote reports and were consulted and did all kinds of work around how to respond to a pandemic event. And I think all of us were utterly aghast at how none of what we had worked on seemed to have been taken off the shelf to be looked at in either the United States or the United Kingdom, which are the two countries I know, because I am originally from the States, but I live in the UK and work in the UK, but have worked at, you know, different aspects of what I've just described in both countries. So that was one response. And I know I'm not alone in this because I've spoken with other colleagues who work even at higher levels of government about this, and they've said, we don't know what happened. The other thing that happened to me was I flew to America on March 18th of 2020. So this was at the beginning of what we didn't realize was the beginning, but the beginning of what became the COVID pandemic. And which was a week earlier than I had expected to fly to America to help my parents with some health issues. Previously, at the very end of 2019, my father had a massive cardiac arrest at an airport, Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport, and had died, but then was resuscitated, made a miraculous recovery in ways that we, you know, don't understand totally. And I'm using miraculous loosely here, but that's one of the only ways to describe it. My mom had issues around cancer, so I was going there to help them. And about a week after I arrived, all the borders were basically closed, all the flights were canceled, and I ended up living with my parents for 6 months in America because I couldn't get back to the UK. So I had this experience where, because of the pandemic, I've now spent much more time living and being with my parents, looking after them, caring for them, which is very important to me, than I would have otherwise. And I think about that a lot. And I think about all the people who won't be able to do that. In part because, and this brings me back to my initial point, because their friends and family died from a completely preventable scenario, by and large. And that's what makes me so angry, that so much of this could have been prevented and just wasn't. And I am hoping in the future will be looked at very closely as to why that is the case.
Oh, I'm really sorry about your parents, but I'm really glad that everything worked out and you approached it very mindfully as well.
Well, and my parents are fine. They've been vaccinated. Mm. They're in good health. You know what I mean? Like I have to tell you then too. So then this isn't funny, but some people will be like, well, you would have thought you would have learned your lesson. Then in December of 2020, December 13th, I flew to America again, this time to see my parents for, you know, the holidays, as you do. And then the next week, again, everything got closed. So I then spent 5 months living with my parents again, moving into 2021. And I've just now returned to the UK after a month. And it is, but because everything was done remotely, everything was done online, it was this weird situation where it didn't honestly make a difference where I was in the world because of the work I do, because of my job. And I feel extremely, I've never for a second taken any of that for granted, because there are so many people, and I think we see this in the mortality rates around COVID. You know, it should come as no surprise that the individuals who are dying are the individuals who do not have the time or the money or the social access to not have to directly engage in activities that could put them at risk. And I said as much to my students on the last day that I taught an in-person class, which was March 17th of 2020, for the students who were there before, really, you know, for example, the University of Bath, where I'm a faculty member, shut down. But certainly this was when universities in the UK were just beginning to close down. And I just said to those students, guys, I feel terrible about what you're about to see, because you're about to watch a lot of people die who didn't need to die. And I don't see any other way around that. And one of the reasons I was saying all this was because a lot of my work is, for example, in the history of the AIDS epidemic, particularly the early AIDS epidemic, which is still with us as a pandemic. It's not gone away. Mm. But I said, I am so reminded right now. I actually became quite emotional, which also then kind of freaked my students out. But I'm so reminded of the early years of the AIDS epidemic, and you shouldn't have to see any of this about what there are plans in place, and I don't know why they seem to be followed. So I had this, you know, kind of weird, you know, vacillation between really just anger when I saw it as a complete failure, but also taking a bit of solace, if I can even use that term, to spend time with my parents during a pandemic so I could reflect on what was going on and you know, making sure they were okay, which was important to me.
Yeah, for sure. So you mentioned that you teach at the University of Bath. So can you tell us a little bit more about yourself and what you do?
Sure. So I'm a faculty member in the Department of Social and Policy Sciences at the University of Bath in Southwest England. I'm the director of the Center for Death and Society. So I work in death and dying, broadly defined. The Center for Death and Society was founded in 2005. I joined in 2008. So I've been in the UK for 12 years now, just over 12 years. And my work is largely around death, dying, and dead body interdisciplinary study research areas, by which I mean I cover a large range of topics. My own background, my education was done in the States. So my PhD is from the University of Minnesota in the Department of Cultural Studies, Comparative Literature, the program in Comparative Studies in Discourse and Society. And it's more arts and humanities, I think, stressing on the humanities side than the social sciences world in which I find myself at times. However, really what I ended up working in would be sort of science and technology studies, the history of science and technology, and also bioethics. But as that relates to death and dying, the dead body, what happens to people when they are dying, politics around choices around death and dying, and then also what happens to the dead body, the human corpse, after the person dies, legal, philosophical, to a certain extent, religious concerns around those issues as well.
So how did you get interested in science and specifically the science of death?
That's a great question. I mean, I think death remains one of those topics I got interested in it, to answer your question directly, in part because there's a family history here, which is I've mentioned my parents already, but my father was a funeral director in America for many decades. So I grew up around the funeral industry. I can't say that that's the reason I ended up doing what I do, although it certainly helped. But I had no grand plans, to be clear about this. In fact, when I was in grad school, the Center for Death and Society didn't exist. And indeed, one of my PhD supervisor, John Archer, who's a great PhD supervisor, mostly because he just put up with me at the University of Minnesota. In fact, at one point he was like, "Where are you going to get a job with this?" And I was like, "I don't know, but I'll find it." And I did, like, I don't know what else to say. Like, I did, like, in the way that sometimes these things work. But I think I grew up around death and dying. And I think that for me, the science questions around death have always been in some ways the most interesting. And a lot of it, what it comes down to are these questions around, you know, what is the definition of death? Like, how do we define when someone is dead? And so there's a scientific, a biomedical, a clinical aspect to that around what would be described as the determination of death, the moment of death. But of course, that's also legal, philosophical, religious. It's such a confluence of those points that I've always been really fascinated by not only the science around the definition of death, as in when someone has died, but also to the science around bodily preservation and the technologies that were evolved or developed to preserve the dead body, but also to keep a dying person alive. I mean, one of the areas I'm always intrigued by is, the development of life support technology that we would understand today. So artificial respiration, ventilation, any number of devices that emerged in the 1970s as tools that we humans can use. And, you know, the vast philosophical and ethical dilemmas those tools facilitated, in part because, you know, we humans continue to rethink and redefine what is death. And that, to me, I think is always interesting to study.
So all of this passion that you have and also your wealth of experience are very well encapsulated in your book, Technologies of the Human Corpse. So can you tell us what is it about and how did you come to writing it?
Sure. Thank you very much. The Technologies of the Human Corpse came out with MIT Press. And so the book, a colleague described it as wide-ranging, which I think is a fair description. But it effectively what the book encapsulates or looks at is it's not a linear history here, but a development of how different tools developed by humans to do things with dead bodies have altered and changed perceptions of both what is a dead body, but also how death looks like. So what it looks at, so it starts with, for example, the 19th century in the use of the West predominantly, but you know, tech that was developed for embalming to preserve the dead body in a more reliable method, but also photography and the photographing of the dead, which created a photographic, a copy, an image. And I think that what I was interested in was how these different tools, none of which are technologically determined, and many of your listeners, I would hope that the technological determinism flags would go up around this, none of which is technologically determined. And I make a big point of that because, you know, largely what this is humans using a set of tools. Now, we do tend sometimes to blame the technologies for things that have happened, but that's not the case. Like, we're just using these tools to do different things as they evolve. So how, for example, do preservation technologies that emerged in the 19th century make dead bodies, you know, different, or make them transportable because of the railway system? Now we can talk about the air freight system. How does that alter or change perceptions of death? Like, what is death? What are we supposed to do with these dead bodies? And then you end up in situations in which dead bodies become very problematic. And that would be the AIDS epidemic, for example, in which suddenly, because of a misunderstanding, and in many cases, homophobia, right? What is it about this suddenly scary dead body that is regarded as dangerous as a body exposed to radiation in really the big Cold War threat, which was, you know, what do we do with all the bodies that happen after a nuclear war? I mean, those kinds of questions. And then also then, you know, a whole kind of, if you will, commodification or commodity market around dead bodies. And sometimes what's referred to as body brokering, or the idea of this is not organ donation, which is separate, but the buying and selling of human tissues and bones to use in both experimentation, but also for, you know, biomedical products, exhibitions, in using dead bodies, for example, Body World. So it's a long list of things, but really what I'm interested in is just how we humans have made sense, starting in the 19th century in the West predominantly, with what the dead body is and can be and can become through a kind of external technological innovation, quote unquote. And in many cases, the dilemmas that has created for us as a species, as far as that goes.
You're asking super fascinating questions I never thought I actually had.
Well, that's my job as director of the Center for Death and Society. It's what I do full time. And, but you're right. And I think that, I mean, again, this, you asked about getting into this. I mean, I think that's one of the things where my background growing up around the funeral industry, for me, like growing up around funerals and dead bodies was just totally normal. And I'm not saying that to be cavalier. I'm just saying it was just normal. It was like what my dad did, you know, and we never lived in the funeral home. And I know I always point that out because people will start to imagine this sort of 6 feet under television show, you know, world. That was not it. We never lived in the funeral home, but I certainly grew up around them. And it was just normal. It was just normal. And so for me, I think that sort of that everydayness of the fact that people die has helped contribute to the way I understand, or in my own mind, attempt to look at research around all these topics.
Okay, so let's get into science a little bit. So when was the earliest practices discovered around human bodies before we go on to 19th century?
Yeah, well, now you're into a really great topic, because if you want to get archaeologists really arguing, which I'm always fond of doing, you can start asking about what the Neanderthals were doing with their dead. because there's evidence in different Neanderthal caves or settlements caves that have been discovered that the Neanderthals were burying their dead. And the question has always been, and they found what would be described as different grave goods or objects, things like that. The question has always been, were the dead being buried for ceremonial ritual reasons that we might use today? Or is it possible, and maybe it's not an or, could be an and, they were buried because they were decomposing and smelled? So, and I have to be frank, I tend to side with the decomposing and smelling part, which is not to say there is no ritual involved in that. But I think that what we're getting into is, so if we talk about technological innovation around dead bodies, one of the most significant and I would say important human inventions in this regard was the digging of the grave. Because the grave space, the burial space, doesn't happen on its own. That has to be invented. And that's been an invention that's still with us today, obviously, because we still do it. And so when we talk about like the earliest methods, and then we can move all the way through different ancient civilizations and what they were up to, and the use of fire, the not use of fire for things like cremation, you know, different cultural practices, whatever it might be. Then, of course, we want to talk about mummification and preservation in the Egyptian, system of body preservation, which, of course, we're still talking about today because we still find endlessly fascinating, you know, moving all the way then through to anatomical study, particularly in what we think of being the early modern and Renaissance period, and this idea of the cutting open of the dead body. And this becomes a crucial moment to understand pathology and to understand pathological anatomy, that you can look at one, a healthy organ and an unhealthy organ, and you can begin to figure out, and this becomes one of the crucial moments in science, causation. And the causation that can be determined by looking at a dead body. And I think that the invention of the autopsy becomes a huge moment, particularly in 17th into 18th century science, philosophy, natural philosophy, in which suddenly there's an understanding that looking into the interior of the human body, there are ways to understand why people died. And I think that the ability to determine causation from that set of tools is with us today, so much so that when we have an indeterminate cause, or it's not possible to say why a person died for any number of reasons, it really bothers us, because we have so philosophically come to understand that death is something that can be determined. They were living, they're dead, there must be a causation. But what if you can't determine the causation? So I think that is both a practical situation that then becomes a very philosophical understanding of death itself. And then we move into the 19th century, where I was talking about in terms of, preservation, advances in germ theory. Well, not germ theory, advances in concepts of more around causation, around disease. And, as more and more understanding of, why a person died. I mean, one of the reasons you have to understand, the reason I'm sort of moving this way through it is because, for many centuries, the answer to why a person died is it was God's will, which is it's a solid argument. I mean, it works if enough people are like, why did they die? It was God's will. Okay. You know what I mean? And you will still hear that sometimes in different forms. But I think by and large today in the West, as it's developed, if we were to say, why did they die? Well, it was God's will. I think many people would say, I kind of want more than that. I would like a better understanding of what's going on here.
Yeah, there's a cleaver in somebody's head. Yeah. I would like some answers.
Yeah, I would like to know more than it's God's will. So, or God wills it, that kind of thing. So I think that as we begin to see a shift from a theological to a more secular understanding of humanity. And even someone, philosophically in the 17th century, like René Descartes, writing about, investigations in anatomical study and how he's trying to make sense of what that can mean in terms of, a world created by God or a world understood by man. I mean, we can get into, you know, really, you know, big areas of metaphysics, but like the whole gist of so much of that is, as soon as we humans understand that we can begin to do things with our dead bodies to make sense of ourselves, that, you know, then we're off and running in terms of any number of technological scientific innovations that we can produce.
So can you describe a couple of technologies that were developed in the 19th century, the most notable ones perhaps?
Sure. Well, the 19th century ones I've already alluded to a little bit were, embalming of the dead. Not just embalming of the dead, because preservation of the dead body was something that anatomists in previous centuries had really struggled with. They were always trying to figure out preservation methods so they could spend more time studying the dead, because it was a real issue, which is why there was a whole market around digging up the dead or a more recently dead body. So there was an effort to try and do this, but it's in the 19th century that you have a series of embalmers, Ganahl in France, and then Thomas Holmes in America. And what they're able to do is develop a mechanical chemical reproducible method in which, through a pump system, you develop venal and arterial infusion of the dead body with a preservative embalming solution that then more or less reduces the impact of, if you will, nature on the dead body, and then also, in effect, removes the dead body for a prolonged period of time from our everyday temporality. And so this is why I became really interested, because embalming in this reproducible method that could be then done, because reproducibility was always a key thing, it meant that suddenly there was more time, there was more space, there were more things that could be done to a dead body, and that became a crucial shift in how we understood the temporality of death, where suddenly it wasn't necessary to bury the dead as soon as possible. Now, there are still religious and cultural groups that do that, certainly within Judaism and Islam, other religions, those of the Abrahamic fold, those being the two dominant, but even within conservative Christian groups, you'll find as well, burial within 24 hours or as soon as possible, no embalming, nothing like that. So I think that preservation, and it's much maligned today, and understandably so. I think a lot of people who are not interested or that keen on a kind of preservation system like that, and I get all that, but I think it had a pronounced impact in how we think about, if you basically even just the transferring of the dead body into different places. So that's one. Another big one would be like photography, which was not about death, but obviously, once you can take photographic images, dead bodies, deceased loved ones start being photographed right away. That should not come as a surprise. If you can say anything about the history of communication and visual media technologies that we humans have developed, it's that we use them with our dead loved ones right away. The same was true of the telegraph line. It was used right away to explain that someone had died, or certainly to make sure that shipping of the deceased went as planned. And that, you know, once we begin to understand the different ways to communicate both that someone has died, but also to capture that their use. And that's why when we talk about digital technologies today, the foundations are laid in the 19th century. There's no question about that in my mind. I don't think they can be different, but that's in the 19th century we begin to see it. There's also the invention of like anti-grave robbing technologies, right? You can find these online. They're great blueprints. Google Patents has a lot of them, where, you know, devices, you know, guns, cannons that are loaded to fire if you open the vault without the proper, key or lock, but also then, and this is true, I've always wanted to do a project around this, anti-premature burial devices. I've always wanted to build some and then have myself buried and then, you know, try them out to see if they work.
Oh, dear.
Well, I mean, you know, it's sort of like an experiment, or maybe just make some models, but like, you know, ringing bells or horns to, you know, if you wake up suddenly, you come to and you're like, I'm not dead. And you ring a bell or you hit a button. So like a horn sounds or something like that.
I mean, so no, for sure. And people sometimes use the mobile phones, don't they?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, they'll put, they'll stick. It's pretty common to stick a phone with someone in the coffin. Yeah. Today, which is more or less, I think, just an object that, you know, you can think of this almost as a grave good, like an object that you would put with something. I actually am interested in this because, of course, those devices are going to exist long after we're all dead. And so it will vex future archaeologists, I'm sure, as to what the hell are these things. But nonetheless, yeah.
So as we move to the 20th century, were there any notable developments then?
Sure. Well, of course. I mean, I think so. Yes, significant ones. I mean, I think that as far as preservation technologies go, everything we're talking about in the 19th century moves into the 20th century. But then, of course, it becomes electrified, motorized. And so those are key differences. The photographing of the dead doesn't disappear, although we don't see the photos on display. They would have been done in the 19th century, which is one of the key things. And I think you can argue that that the photograph of the dead has actually expanded, particularly with people's phones. They're not on display the way they were, in which in the Victorian period, people would have the deceased, sometimes parents holding the dead child on display for other people to see. But I think that's continued. I do think one of the major innovations in the 20th century, and it's one that, I mean, it's not that we take it for granted today, but it's one we don't think about as much, was the development of cadaveric donation for organ transplantation and the understanding that you could use organs from a deceased individual to help keep another person alive. And so I think that was an idea that had been around for a long time. So it was experimented on, you know, going back a number of centuries, but the idea that could be done and could be done through a combination of both surgery and, pharmaceutical, help or drug help, that became a thing that is now with us. And I think, you know, has genuinely saved many, many people's lives, in part because they have, kidney, a heart, particularly a heart or a lung, from someone who died. And I think that was a significant breakthrough.
Yeah, for sure. Successful transplantation was a huge development. And
I mean, successful and reproducible. I mean, that becomes so that it becomes standardized in a way. And it is possible to have, of course, living donors, and we can talk about kidneys and other, body parts that way, but particularly the heart. And I think that, and as, you know, as I talk with my students about this in my sociology of death class, I said, the thing about the heart is if you're going to donate your heart, it means you have to be dead because there's no other way around that. And interestingly, that opens up an older philosophical question, which is one that you can even make the case that René Descartes was struggling with in his own writings. I've always read Discourse and Method that way, but this way, which is, you know, so where is the person, right? Where is the person? Is the person in the brain or is the person in the heart? And, you know, philosophically for a long time, many centuries, the answer was the heart, because it was where, you know, we think about the soul. I'm not using soul here, but I'm using this idea of the person. Now, of course, we think about it as being very neurologically driven. Like the person is in the brain. But this is why you still have groups that will say, as long as the person's heart beats, they are alive. Which has been created all kinds of problems once we get into artificial ventilation and life support in the 1970s, because their heart could be beating, but is the person still there? And I bring all this up because I'll throw that one at my undergrads, and they will go all over the place with that one. because they're, you know, they're like, oh my God, I haven't thought about, I don't know. And then they'll, and you'll find a lot of them will say, no, it's the heart. It's not the brain. I think that's where the person is. So I think that there's a kind of legacy of that when we talk about something like heart transplantation.
It's fascinating. So you already mentioned how opening the corpse really revolutionized our understanding of the disease and trying to really look at the causation part with all the pathology. So how are the body parts used today in the sciences to really inform us on the processes in the living bodies? And maybe some ethical quandaries that surround it as well?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. I mean, how dead bodies are used today is multifold. There's multi-purposes going on. So on the one hand, we've already talked about organ transplantation, but I'm going to step away from organ transplantation when I answer this question, because organ transplantation, organ donation is largely, and here I mean vital organs, is something that is regulated in a way that what I'm about to talk about is not. So, and also I would say that organs are privileged in a way, they're heroicized in a way, which I think is legit, that are different than, let's say, bone and tissue donation. That there is a whole other world of both medical research, but also industrial products that are made that do not involve organs, because that is something that is seen as just being different. So what do I mean by other products? Well, for example, in addition to being an organ donor, as many people are, as I am, you can also be a bone and tissue donor, which I am as well, skin donor. So it is possible to the older term, which isn't so much used now, is harvest or extract bones, tissues, from an individual who has died and use those for both medical treatments, if you will. So for example, using skin for burn units, or also using bones to create different kinds of bone screws or medical devices to be used, more organic materials for surgical procedures. But you can also, for example, donate your eyes, and eye banks collect corneas to use for different procedures. That actually, interestingly enough, that the eyes are the one thing that a lot of people don't want to donate. And I found this with my students too. I'd never thought about that, but I read about it, that many people are really, in fact, I have to be careful when I start talking about eye donation in my class, because it just drives a lot of students absolutely up the wall to think about it. There's just something about the idea of donating one's eyes for the corneas, or eye enucleation, as it's called, that a lot of people cannot handle. And in fact, some of your listeners right now might be like, stop talking about the eyes. I don't want to, you know, I'm having a panic attack. But that, you know, there are ways that over the years, what have developed is there's a whole system of, if you will, buying and selling of human tissues and body parts for different industrial experiments. So for example, impact studies around car impacts. The military has done experiments around the impact of different explosive devices. I mean, the list can go on and on. Effectively, if you want to try and study what an accident or what some kind of disaster situation might do to living humans, then you will attempt, because for various, I think, very understandable ethical reasons, not try and use living humans to do this, in part because human subject research has a long history of the most horrific of human subject research being done in that way. There will be an attempt to use, or there will be the use of human cadavers or human cadaver parts. And it's a whole industry. And I think that there have been real scandals, which can be an overused term, but scandals that have emerged when it became clear. And if you have individuals who are, you know, responsible for medical schools listening to this podcast, I want to make it clear that this is not me casting aspersions on medical schools or cadaver, body donation programs. And I'm not. I think that what has happened is you've had individuals who figured out that the laws were very loose, particularly in the United States, but it's, you know, you'd be shocked to find it around the world, where it is possible effectively to kind of transfer through what's referred to as a body brokering system, you know, heads, legs, teeth, body parts of deceased individuals to, you know, private buyers, oftentimes from kind of big corporations. And that it's not against the law, that there's not a legal problem with it. That's different than organs. Organs you can't buy and sell, but that tissues, things like bones, skin, that those materials can be, although you're never directly buying them, you're buying the handling service. So that's the key thing, right? So say, Galina, you say to me, I need some femurs to do research. I say, okay, I can get you the femurs, but let's make this clear. You're not buying the femurs. You're buying my time and services to deliver them to you. Do we understand that? And you say, yes. And then we're in compliance with the law. So what happens is there's been a history of donation to different med schools and different body donation programs. Again, very legitimate. It's important to have, I think, anatomical study that way, or cadaver labs sometimes, as it's been called. Very important. But that oftentimes too, when you sign over the individual for the program, you are in many cases signing over the entirety of, if you will, rights. And here we get into a weird legal area around, you know, who owns the dead body, which could be a whole podcast into itself. Mm. But this is where then you end up in these situations where, you know, individuals who would be described as bad actors determine that they can do this within the law. And indeed, in many of the cases, as I cover in chapter 5 of my book, individuals are prosecuted under tax evasion. So they're prosecuted for not paying taxes on money they're paid, not for actual anything to do with the body parts.
That is so interesting. So just so many different things and actors that come into play here.
Yeah. And I want to make it clear before you start getting emails or tweeting, like people talking about the value of what there is a real value to this work. I want to be clear about that. But I think that what has gone on has been so the more ethical, I think, and there's absolutely ethical ways to do this, I think. And by and large, many families will say, you know, if I'd been told that this was going to happen, I would have been fine with it. It's that they're just never told. So there's no, I think, what is the bedrock principle of so much of human subject research post-World War II is informed consent. Right. If you have informed consent, that's a starting point, and I think a very crucial one. And that's just not been there. And then you get into cases of fraud because individuals are trying to make more money. And that, of course, is illegal. So people are falsifying documents. That is illegal. You can't do that. So I think there are ways to do all this, but that in order to, and here we can start to talk about a critique of capitalism, in order to, I think, make more money faster, there have been any number of corners, to use a term, have been cut. And that's when you end up with all the problems you've got. But there are other ways to do it. And I think that there are reputable, ethical ways that would be within compliance for human subject research to do it. So, I mean, the trick is, I know I'm going on and on about this, but there's a key distinction here, which is, so when you die, when you or I die, we are still human, right? We're still human. Are you with me on this? So we are still human. Like, we are a human body, but we are not persons. So
wow, interesting.
Personhood, legally speaking, only exists as a, what has been described as a legal fiction. It's a legal category. So if you are human, you are a person when you can function outside of the womb. So we can get into all kinds of questions around reproductive rights too. and this gets into the abortion debates in America. And there's all kinds of ways, but that personhood as a category, which is why corporations will be persons, but as a legal category, we are persons until we die, at which point we are no longer persons. We are still human, but we are effectively a quasi-subject, but also then a quasi-object. So how does the law make sense of, if you will, this human body that's no longer a person, so you don't have all the legal rights, but then you have next of kin who will say, no, that is my, I have a legal obligation or a legal right or whatever it might be to deal with the individual who's deceased. However, then we enter into very uncomfortable terrain, which would be something along the lines of questions of property. And that's not what we are. So that's what I'm saying. Like, we start to think about that. You can think about these philosophically, but these are very, very important legal distinctions that really come.
I really appreciate, yeah, that you brought up these clarifications. And I think that what your book really serves really great purpose to bring all of this into the spotlight. Because being realistic, most of us actually feel that this world is just so far away. And we don't really know how, and you know, how our bodies are going to be taken care of after we die. Of course, we can make arrangements. But if you would like to donate your femur to science, for example, I'm not really sure I know how.
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm going to make it clear. I'm signed up in both the UK and the United States as a full organ donor, but then also bone and tissue donor. I want everything that can be used, particularly my organs, if they can be used, if I die in a way that they can be used, because sometimes that is not the case. Bone and tissue donation is a little bit easier. I'm using the term easier. I mean, it's not as conditional on how you die, but that, I fully consent to that. I also, in doing so, understand that I may not have any control over how those bones, tissues, and organs may be used. I have no ability to pre-select or predetermine any of that. And I accept that, and I'm okay with that. I'm making an informed consensual choice to do that. But I think that that's the part you need to explain more to people. And that I think that for me, I think it is possible to do, but that it just, it, that hasn't, that's been, there's been a gap in the explanation that way.
Yeah, for sure. So there are a few concepts around dead bodies and technologies that came into public eye, and now and then they resurface. So for example, like exhibition body worlds, but also body farms. Right. Can you maybe give us a bit of an explanation of any of those?
Sure. Well, I think we need to draw a big distinction between the body farm research facilities and body worlds. In part because,
oh, yeah, for sure.
I know. In part because if anyone who works for any of the body research facilities is listening right now, they might be sort of like pounding their fists on the thing, like, no. But I think let's take them separately. So the most famous of the body farms would be, of course, the body farm down in Tennessee, which was started as an idea by Bill Bass, and this idea of an anthropological research facility. There's a funny anecdote about this, and there's a documentary that was made about it that I was interviewed for that I'd never known. But so Bill Bass was one of these anthropologists, forensic anthropologists, and what he decided was, if we're going to try and study, you know, proper criminal investigation, forensic investigation, how people die, we need to create a facility in which we can create replicate scenarios in which we find dead bodies to study what happens. And it was a really novel idea, and one that has now been replicated in lots of different areas around the world. But the idea for the original name, I'm not joking when I say this, was the Bass Anthropological Research Facility, which of course the acronym was BARF. So they realized, okay, we can't do that. So it was, you have like this anthropological research facility, which the shorthand has just become the body farm, in which down in Tennessee, they've created these different scenarios. It's been much publicized. It's been, you know, written about. It's been all kinds of documentaries. Stephen Fry here in the UK went down there. So it's been looked at. Other places have opened them too around the world. Australia, across different parts of America. I mean, they've become an interesting spot to do study. Interestingly enough, one of the things that's come out of some of the study has been, has the soil in some instances become too contaminated by previous research so that it's actually impacting the results that people are finding. That there might be a limited use for some areas. Now, there's different research in trying to prevent that, but that in some cases, maybe the, you know, the research itself needs to rethink exactly what's going on. But certainly entomologists have been crucial here. So forensic entomology and the study of how different bugs, insects are found or located around dead bodies, that's been a huge area in development that way. So that's the body farm. That's really about, you know, figuring out, you know, criminal analysis and forensic analysis that way. Then you have things like exhibitions of dead bodies, which are different but similar, even to, for example, like exhibitions of you know, Egyptian mummies, but in a different kind of way. That Gunther von Hagens starts in the mid 90s, and Gunther von Hagens is a German anatomist and actually worked for many years in pathology and pathological anatomy, and actually really he did create an important contribution through the plastination process, in which you can preserve human organs, for example, for study in both a more rigid but also a more flexible preservation process, so that students could study them. And that actually was a real contribution, and he's thinking this through in terms of educational ideas. But then what he comes up with is this idea, but I can do this to whole bodies, and then we can put them on display. And the Body Worlds exhibitions have been around since the mid 90s. And, you know, there's actually a whole Body Worlds site now in London in Piccadilly, which is like they've taken over a building as an exhibition space. So it's moved back and forth. So in Europe, continental Europe, for many years, the only place you would find Body Worlds would be in exhibition spaces. They were not, as they were found in the United States, and this is a crucial distinction, in science and technology museums, in part because across Europe, many science and technology museums wanted nothing to do with Body Worlds, in part because there were questions about the provenance of the bodies or what was going on. Mm-hmm. Whereas in the United States, the science and technology museums were like, come on in. And in fact, I saw Body Worlds for the first time at a science and technology museum at the Minnesota Science Museum in St. Paul. And I think that distinction is crucial, since we've been talking about science all the time. To see Body Worlds in an exhibition space is to see a different exhibition than to see it in a science museum. And I think just by entering the science museum space, it changes, I think, how it's understood. That would be my argument. Both you know, epistemologically, if I can use epistemology in this podcast, and I think I can. But as well, you know, in terms of just a broader understanding of what's going on. Now, but Gunther von Hagens will tell you his whole project is to democratize anatomy. He wants to bring anatomy to the people and help people talk about death and dying. I don't actually think that's going on in Body Worlds so much. My whole take on Body Worlds is it conveys to people that when they die, they can look awesome. Their dead bodies can be amazing looking, because if it was truly an exhibition of dead bodies, you would not see any of that. If it was an exhibition around thinking about death, whatever it might be, you wouldn't see that. Now you can see anatomical structures, which I think is fascinating, but of course, then there's all different kinds of choices that are going on. And he moved into different areas then, starting in like about 2009, 2010. Where they started posing dead bodies engaged in sexual acts. And that, you know, of course, created nothing but controversy, which then did nothing but drive up ticket sales. And they've also engaged in, preserving dead animals, which I find interesting. These are animals that are donated from zoos that have died, because I think that, you know, in some cases, you can imagine that animal species becoming extinct in the future, but what's left are these plastinated remains. So that to me has always been fascinating. But also too, I think just in general, the plastination process creates dead bodies that are going to be around way, way after, again, we as a species are dead. And so, or, you know, we humans living now are dead. And so that's going to actually then also create, I think, weird issues for future archaeologists or historians. Like, what were they doing with their dead bodies? Mm. And, you know, does something like Body Worlds become representative of the late 20th, early 20th, 21st century moment of dead body technology? Does it come to be represented as this is what they were doing when actually it was just a series of exhibitions?
Yeah, for sure. And exhibitions like that and similar things, they really make you think. And especially as you mentioned, we have animals and we have humans, and many people would look at dead animals a little bit in a different way. And then you're given opportunity to look at a dead human and you start thinking about your own relationship to dead bodies. So I was just wondering, what insights have you gathered about our society when thinking about how we perceive and what we do with the dead bodies?
Yeah, no. So that's a good question too. I mean, I think that the one thing I think to stress is that, you know, since the 1970s, particularly across the West, and this is across the West, so this is not a specifically like Anglo West thing. But, you know, we've had it drilled into our heads that death is this taboo and that it's impossible to talk about, it's repressed. I think the exact opposite is true, quite frankly. I think the taboo argument was brought forward as a way to create sort of death social movements to challenge. So death social movements begin to take shape in the 1970s to like sort of, embrace death, and that they needed something to work against. So what they were saying is death is this taboo and we got to get rid of this taboo and we need to be, you know, really up with death. And I think that that's continued, where actually I think the exact opposite is true. I don't think death is a taboo at all. There might be people who don't like talking about it, but there are a lot of people who don't like talking about lots of things like credit card debt or rats or snakes or spiders, you know what I mean? That kind of thing. So there'll be people who don't like things. I don't think it's a taboo. In fact, one of the things I've learned really across my life, but particularly in my research as director of the Center for Death and Society at the University of Bath, and in my book, Technologies of the Human Corpse by MIT Press, is people really want to talk about death and dying. The sociology of death class that is taught in my department is filled to capacity every year with a waiting list. Students genuinely enjoy taking the class. People really want to hear, you know, public lectures on this material. And in fact, I think if you can say anything, is that death has always been extremely popular, certainly, let's say, post-World War II, as a topic that people really want to engage with and talk about. And that it's not a question of, I think, repression or taboo or any of that. What's happened is we've moved away as a sort of a society or civilization in the West, because there are many parts of the world where I think you would find people who would say, I really wish we didn't have to talk about death so much. And even I think you would find social groups within the West who would say, in our communities, it would be nice not to have to talk about death so much. So this really is a question, I think, of both affluence as well as, in a certain case, social class. But that people really do want to talk about death. They want to have an opportunity to say, this is what I'm thinking. Now, there might be an initial kind of like, well, I don't know, it makes me kind of feel uncomfortable, but that's just the initial response. And once you get going, they'll be like, yeah, I want to talk about this. And I'm interested in all these topics around death and dying. I find it super fascinating. I never thought about that. And I think I'm hopeful if anything comes out of my book, it's just that it encourages people to, you know, to have those conversations and to realize it's not that difficult. It might be awkward, but then we have awkward conversations all the time about lots of things. And it's once you get past that, it's fine. It can be done.
Interesting. So I was wondering, do topics around dead bodies give you nightmares? And what is your relationship to Halloween?
So nightmares, no. Never had an issue with that. Halloween, that's a good question. Funny story, two funny stories about Halloween. One is, so in my office on campus, of course, I've got, you know, different skeletons and skulls and death memorabilia stuff that have just been given to me over the years. Because I guess that's what you give a person who studies death. You know what I mean? Like, hey, look, a skeleton. I'll give it to the guy I know who studies death. And you put it in, I have to put it in my office because I'm like, I don't know where else I'm going to put this stuff. And an undergraduate was in my office, this is a few years back, and she said, oh, wow. Or I should say, this is in October, right? And she said, "Oh wow, I really like your Halloween decor in your office. It's really cool." And I was like, "What?" And she said, "Well, yeah, like the skeleton here and that and the skull." And I was like, "Oh no, no, that's not Halloween decor. That stuff's here all the time." And she was like, "Oh, okay." I didn't even think about it. You know what I mean? Like, I was like, "Oh yeah, no, that stuff's just there." You know what I mean? Like, that's a Halloween decor. But I did a few years ago. I'm sure people can find this. The online publication, The Conversation, asked me to write something about Halloween, and I just was like, I think Halloween is the most boring holiday ever. It was a bit satirical. It was a bit tongue in cheek, but boy, did people get angry with me about that one. They're like, you know what I mean? It was like, mm-hmm. My point was just simply saying, like, if I have to see, you know, one more Anglo gringo person with a Day of the Dead something mask on, whatever it might be, I'm just going to go crazy. You know, it was more about like appropriation of different, you know, cultural practices, which mm-hmm. again, that's not new, but I mean, I was trying to, you know, draw a point open it. So as far as Halloween goes, you know, I'm fine with it. I'm usually too busy though. I'm very busy, you know, academic, very important life, very important research, you know, so I just don't usually have time for Halloween, but I do like monsters. I like monster movies. So there's that.
Yeah, for sure. You are not short on the conversation starters.
Yeah, indeed. Yes, you've nailed it. Absolutely. So,
well, John, we've taken up a lot of your time. So I would like to ask, what are you currently working on and what would be your next project?
So a couple of things. My editor, Matt Brown at MIT Press, who's a brilliant editor, he is talking to me and after me, really chasing, I think is perhaps the best term, to do more work around something I started immediately or really during the COVID pandemic when I first started looking at the AIDS epidemic and COVID, and trying to understand a pandemic within a pandemic, as it were. But this would build on the historical work I've done looking at AIDS and the AIDS epidemic itself and trying to understand, you know, what was learned or what was forgotten from that pandemic. During this pandemic. So there's that. Another sort of ongoing project, I haven't put this one together, but one project I've always wanted to do and haven't had a chance to do yet would be a series of interviews with other children of funeral directors from around the world. Because the informal conversations I've had with other children of funeral directors, we've all had similar-ish experiences. And in a kind of uncanny sense, which I guess makes sense, but also in strange ways you wouldn't necessarily expect. So I've always wanted to do, you know, what it is to be the child of a funeral director who grows up in a world, you know, where you are by definition, because of that, just very unique. But then around the world, how do different children, you know, in conflict zones or in different parts of, you know, non-English speaking world, how do they understand what they do or how the world operates? So there's that. I'm trying to think. I should have come up with a long list of projects just to you know, list off there. But there's all different kinds of research that's, you know, it's always going on that way.
That sounds super interesting. So where can our listeners find more information about your work and also the technologies on the human corpse?
Sure. Well, I think, obviously I want to put in a plug here for the Center for Death and Society at the University of Bath. We have a newsletter and it's free. You can always go to the University of Bath website or just Google Center for Death and Society. We're the only one, so you'll find us. Mm-hmm. But the Center for Death and Society is on, it's on Facebook. It's also on Twitter. My own personal work, you can find me, probably the best place to check would be on two places. One would be on Twitter. So I tweet under the name The Death Reference Desks, which was a project that was started with a couple of librarians that I've more or less kind of it's morphed into me working on it more myself, which is fine. That's the way projects go. And that's Death Reference Desk on Twitter. It's just at Death Ref. So Death and then REF. Like I'm the ref, the referee of death. I don't know if that's true, but like Death Ref. Also, I've got a website, johntroyer.com, because everyone's got a website. And you can find stuff there. I think the other place to find more information about my book. So the book Technologies of the Human Corpse, I'll try and say it as many times as possible, is available in all the places. It comes out in paperback in August, but it is available in all the places you would find books online. And I mean, all the places, big independent or big, you know, big sellers, small independents. And you can also find it at the MIT Press website. And if you just Google Technologies of the Human Corpse, you should be taken to it. But yeah, you can find it in all the places you would find books, both book form and I believe ebook form as well. But yeah, please do, please. And if you ever, for some reason happen to be around me, I don't know why anyone would, or I suppose when social distancing is no longer around us, whenever that might be, and you have the book, I will happily sign it. If you want me to sign it, you don't have to have me sign it, but I'm saying, cause that could be awkward if I'm like, I'll sign your book. And you're like, I don't really want you to. I'm like, okay. But if you do, I'll happily sign the book. And I'll say, especially if you explain, because it was Galena's important and crucial interview I heard you with. So yeah, so you can find it all those places that way. Or just email me at the University of Bath and I'll figure it out how you can get a book that way. So that's fine.
And don't send any more Halloween paraphernalia.
Yeah, don't send any more. I have more Halloween. Honestly, I'm not joking when I say over the years, people have been like, it's every year when Halloween decor comes out in the shops, you know, the stores, and people are like, I saw this, I thought of you, I thought I'd buy it for you. And I'm like, great, thanks. I honestly have like a shelf that's partially just got stuff from Halloween that people have bought me, yeah, in my office. I really do. And it, you know, because I appreciate people thinking of me. I do. But it's funny how that happens every year. Yeah.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for joining me today. It has been a really fascinating conversation.
Yeah, no, thank you. Thank you for the opportunity. I really appreciate it. And I certainly hope all the, the listeners have had a chance to, you know, think through any number of topics related to death and dying. And I would encourage everyone to think through particularly organ donation, bone and tissue, opportunities. And, you know, certainly I think being a donor is an important thing.